Yo, yo, welcome to Crypto 101, the average consumer's guide to cryptocurrency. This is Matthew Aaron, and today we have two more 101s on two projects in the crypto space. We're going to get into those just in a moment, and I apologize. This intro is a little bit shorter than usual because I am still in New York for Blockchain Week in the middle of Consensus. And let me tell you guys, everything you heard about Consensus is true and even more. Everybody's there, great parties, great information. It's blockchain 24/7 in New York for about a week. So if you've never been to New York for Blockchain Week, I recommend it. You don't have to buy tickets to all the conferences. Just come, hang out, go to the parties, and meet people. It's worth it. Before we get into these two 101s, wherever you're listening to this podcast, please make sure you're subscribed, leave us a rating and a comment. It helps us stay visible. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, crypto_101, and my personal Twitter, Matthew_101. This is not trading advice, legal advice, financial advice, and not personal advice. And I want to say thank you to the Crypto 101 editors for editing these tracks. Now, without further ado, I want to say thank you for listening. And here's 101s on two projects in the crypto space. We'll see you after the show. Pavel Bain, CEO and co-founder of Blue Zelle. Welcome to Crypto 101, sir.
Hey, Matthew. Thanks for having me on here today.
Thanks for having you again. And what people don't know is we actually recorded this. We had technical troubles and we have to do this again. It kind of sucks, but I hope to make it as authentic and natural as we did the first time.
Yeah, I think we'll be all right.
But hey, really quick before we get into everything, please tell us a little bit about yourself and tell us about the origin of Blue Zelle.
Yeah, so like I said, my name is Pavel, co-founder, CEO of Blue Zelle. Traditionally came from the digital media video game space and got into blockchain about 4 years ago. I just got interested in the technology. And so funny story about the name Blue Zelle was when we first started the company, my co-founder and I, we just needed a working name and we just came up with Blue Street. And so, you know, we're like, okay, that's just our working title. BlueStreet.com was taken, so we had BlueStreet.co, which kind of bothered us. And we just started working on, okay, we need a new name. You're trying all these combination, domains are taken. And so we wanted blue in there because blue, if you look up, is, you know, safety related to money, royalty. So that's why a lot of banks actually use the color blue, we found out. And then I was just planning a trip to go to Tanzania to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. So, you know, obviously started to think about all the gazelles that are there. My family's originally from India, so they have got a lot of the Indian gazelle. And we're like, hey, you know, gazelles are kind of fast. They're agile. They move this and around. And that time, we're just trying to figure out what we're doing. So we're like, hey, that's kind of like us in this whole blockchain space. So we kind of just took blue and gazelle and put it together, and the .com was available.
And voila, that you have it there. You said you were climbing Kilimanjaro?
Yeah. So I did that in 2015. Into 2015.
How tall is that?
It is, so let's see, if we go by feet, it's...
meters is fine too. We have an international audience here.
Well, I think it's just over, it's about 19,500 feet, almost 7,000 meters.
Oh, wow. And you went to the summit?
Yeah, we went right to the top.
Oh, wow. Okay. I think the tallest I've been was 15,000, and that was hard, man. Another 4,000, I think I've been dying.
The last trek, the day up before we descended, that was crazy. And this is from somebody like in my group. I was like, hey, this is pretty cool. I was like, I've never camped before. They're like, you've never gone camping in your life? I was like, no, never. This is my first time sleeping outdoors on a tent. And they're like, just shell-shocked.
Yeah. That's funny. We did the same thing. So we decided to hike up the tallest tallest mountain in Taiwan called Yushan.
Yeah.
And it's about 14 and a half, 15, I think, and 15,000 feet. And we were just so unprepared. There was no safety measures on the whole mountain. I would probably say Kilimanjaro was probably the same thing. They just had some chains on the side so you didn't fall off a cliff. And everybody was so unprepared. It was below zero. One just wearing jeans, and people were freezing. We're waiting. We're up there early in the morning trying to see the sun come up. It was a disaster.
Oh no, ours is different. Ours was Kilimanjaro doesn't. There's no dangerous parts to climb. It's like a really long hike up the mountain. So you don't need any chains. You just get tired and altitude hits you and that type of stuff. But your life was really never in danger. Like you're holding on to things to make it up. No, it wasn't like that. That's a good thing.
This is not a mountain climbing podcast, even though I wish it was. This is super interesting. Blue Zelle, what do you guys do?
So Blue Zelle is a decentralized data storage. So what that means is what we look at ourselves is building a data delivery network. So if companies are familiar with Cloudflare, which is a content delivery network, which takes website content, pushes it to the edge so it's distributed, so websites load faster. What we did was kind of take that concept and apply blockchain principles, and my co-founder found out that, hey, a distributed data storage or decentralized data storage is actually needed. So what that means is, hey, let's take just blockchain principles, having all, instead of miners, but have nodes or servers out there, take data, break it up, and store it onto all this basically unused hardware that's out there from people. So you've got, you know, let's say you've got a goal would be, let's say you have an Xbox, your laptop, your phone, it's got unused capacity that you'll probably never touch, rent it out to the network. That way we can have people store on there. You can earn some money, and the people are storing are happy because their data is now much more safer. It's available everywhere so they can retrieve it faster. And just like the Bitcoin network never goes down, this data network will never go down. And that's really telling because if you've probably seen the news for the past, you know, a couple of years, internet usage and data creation, data exchange between devices is just getting more and more. You've got like, and by next year, they're saying 6 devices for every connected person on the planet. And they're saying that's 4 billion connected people next year. So That's why you're getting a lot of these things like Cathay Pacific data breaches, Equifax data breaches. Uber, you're getting people saying that data is being manipulated. They can't trust that their data hasn't been tampered with. And our belief is that using blockchain principles, you can apply that to data storage and you can solve all those problems.
Okay, so how does this work? I guess I'm a little confused about what BlueZell is doing still. So it's decentralized data storage. Does that mean like everybody's using this like the old Napster or LimeWire? Is that how it works?
It would take that concept, basically peer-to-peer computers. Now to a customer, let's say you're a game developer and you want to store data on your network, you don't really care. Yeah. You just want, hey, it's got higher security, speed, and availability. Mm-hmm. I don't care what's going on underneath, right?
Right, now, exactly.
What's going underneath is how we allow that to happen is, like you said, Napster and LimeWire is, hey, Matt, you've got an extra computer sitting at home. Boom, turn it on, join our network, let us partition some of it, store some data on there, and you'll get some of our revenues. So basically, you're taking, instead of renting out your house as for Airbnb or room, you're just renting out your computer.
Got it. The thing I remember about like LimeWire and Napster is that it was kind of slow. And you mentioned something about Cloudflare. And I just want to wonder if it works the same. Because, you know, if you have like movies and 4K videos, this is what I'm going to be using it for, right? I'm going to go to YouTube. I'm going to watch MKBHD, see what like new cell phone he's reviewing. And I want that to stream to me 4K, great sound, because he does a lot of good work into his videos. Is it going to be slow and choppy? Am I going to have graded video? But then you mentioned Cloudflare. And the way that I know a little bit about how Cloudflare works is they take your cache or your browsing data and put it in like the countries that are closer to you. For example, if you're a Japanese searching certain websites, they're going to move it to maybe a servers in Japan so you have quicker access, instead of, even though the company might be hosted in Alabama. Is that kind of how it works?
Yeah. So two things is, we're not storing files, so There won't be any slowdown. So we're not doing movie files, music, things like that. We're strictly data behind devices. So if you're an IoT device, let's say you're a video game and you got leaderboards that need to be refreshed all the time, that's the data behind that is stored on ours. So you won't have those issues as like LimeWire and Napster downloading things. Now, the Cloudflare model is correct, is because using a decentralized network, what we're doing is, hey, we've got servers set up everywhere. So once again, the data that's most relevant at that time. So if you look at it as, like I said, we're building a data storage technology, first rollout is it to act like a cache. So that way more people can start using it. And then the data that they're storing will be at the edge closest to, let's say the players in Mumbai playing a game. Let's just say it's Fortnite and they need the latest scores or leaderboards or what's happening. It's going to retrieve the data from a server closest to them, as opposed to going all the way back to, let's say, North Carolina, where Epic might have their Fortnite databases set up.
Got it. A lot of people are making companies using blockchain, but blockchain sometimes isn't really needed in these instances. Why is blockchain needed in this instance?
Well, technically, BlueZell isn't a blockchain. It is a decentralized network just using blockchain principles. So by that, we mean, hey,
distributed. The decentralization properties or?
Yeah. Like, so basically, hey, it's decentralized. We're using, you know, the consensus algorithm, because that can assure like, hey, if a server is on our network or a server or a node, it's acting in good faith. If it's not doing things, we can kick it off. And then we're also using like, you know, basically cryptographic security behind it. Now, the one part of the blockchain we do use for the network, and this is, like I said, to the end customer, they're blind to it, is we'll use Ethereum smart contracts to validate that, hey, the nodes are acting in good faith, they're following our proper manners, and that, let's say, Matthew, you store data on our network, it's never been tampered. We know that only you were the only one who had access to it and who could change it. Mm-hmm. So really, like I said, we're more of a decentralized network which uses blockchain principles or technologies.
Got it. And if you're using the, your, say for example, you're using the empty space in my hard drive to store some of this stuff, I would get paid to store it with the BlueZell token.
That's correct.
Okay, cool. Excellent, excellent. Just out of curiosity, how much storage would you need to store all the data? Because data, there's a lot of data. This is like, everybody keeps talking about data, and there's a shit ton of data. Like how much data is generated every day. Have you ever calculated how much storage you will need to satisfy all the data needs if everybody was using, say, BlueZell? And is that possible with decentralized or distributed systems?
That's a capacity question. So
that is a capacity question.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
So for us, we haven't done the number like what's a total we need. We just know that, okay, what do we have available right now, and how many by average of what customer, how much a customer will store, how many customers we can serve at a given point. Surprisingly, as much as people think, it's fragmented, more data centers are popping up because the big companies are starting to realize that this is actually needed, and they need to start running some of their servers more efficiently, setting up new things, renting out from each other. So I don't think we'll have in terms of the infrastructure or hardware out there available, that will be there to service everybody's needs. It's us being able to tap into all that unused space and join it to our network so we can increase our capacity. Now, there's two parts to that is, do we sit there and first build out the supply side and get tons of capacity, but then you might not have any customers. And then the people, let's say, Matthew, you join, you might get frustrated because I joined, but there's no customers, I'm not earning anything. So what we've decided to do is focus on customers, because that's what really matters. And then we have a number of data center or data server providers who have unused capacity who said, hey, you know what, BlueZell, we like what you're doing. We'll try this out. We'll give you some initial stuff, because we're not using it anyways, and let's get this model working.
Mm-hmm. I heard about distributed systems in data storage a lot recently. Are there competitors that you have that are trying to enter the same market that you are at the same time? And what sets you apart from these other competitors?
So if you look at traditional centralized file storage or data storage companies, there's actually many in there. So let's say you go file storage, you have Dropbox, what's the other company? Box. Then you've got Google Drive offering it. You've got a ton of companies. And when there's file transfer, there's lots of different things. When it comes to the B2B, whether it's small to businesses to large enterprises, it's not a winner take all, which is good that you can have lots of players. Microsoft's got their own version of Dropbox. They call it something else. And so if you have a consumer product, it is now become, it's a winner take all. Like there can only be one social network, right? It can only be one video streaming, let's just say. And then same thing in data storage is, you've got different systems that, let's say you've got databases, like MongoDB, then you have Redis, then you have Amazon DynamoDB. So everybody kind of has different ways to do it, and people figure out what they want to do or what's best for their needs. In decentralized file storage, there's people out there like Filecoin Storage. I'm sure in decentralized data storage, there's us, there's a couple others. But our focus really is on not competing against the other decentralized storage companies, because we all want to win. It's more about those centralized ones, the traditional ones like the Redis, MongoDB. How do we perform better than them? Because their customers, when we're trying mass adoption, is people not just working on blockchain apps, but non-blockchain apps, like where 99% of the applications are. We need to convince them to say, hey, it's better to use a product like BlueZell because it's safer, faster, more available. They don't care if it's decentralized or centralized. It's like, does it work and does it make my life easier than using Redis or MongoDB? Now, if we do that, so I think that's got to be the more measuring stick, not other decentralized companies.
As of right now, April 29th, is your company profitable?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No, that's it. I mean, we're all just startups, right? And products just getting out there. First stage is to have this product, the first version of the product release, it's acting as a data cache, ready in the next couple of weeks. Then from that, we can go to the companies we've been talking to before and saying, hey, it's ready, it's working. All the stuff we said on paper to you before, it actually does. Why don't we run some pilots? Goal would be to take those pilots, show those real results, so it's not just coming from us, real companies using it, publish that, and then we can open that up and get more customers and more capacity. When you're focusing on developers, they're always very skeptical. So you need to just kind of show, improve, and keep kind of leveling up. If we went and did a big advertising campaign in an airport, you know, a developer would walk by and be like, I've never heard of Blue Zell. What is that? This
right.
better than these guys? No, I'm totally skeptical to it already.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So like you said, the first thing is to get the products, get the customers, and to then start building out your ecosystem. What products do you have and what products are going to be released?
Yeah, so the first version of it as being a data storage technology is a data cache. So that's where we're talking about like the CloudFirm model. And easiest way to explain this use case would be, let's say, Matthew, you've got a game studio, you launch it, you're based in San Diego, you found a database server, a center in, let's say, Seattle, and you go, great, my game's working, looking like it's working fine. All of a sudden, the game takes off in, let's just say Japan, right? And the players are starting playing it. They're starting to get latency because every time they have to retrieve the data or play the game, there's performance issues because it's got to go all the way back to Seattle to that data center. Now, you quickly call up a company. Hey, let me set up a data center database in Japan, close to that customer, replicate that database, make sure it's all working. Okay, good. I solved that problem. In that whole time, you know, your developers are now acting like IT guys, and you might have lost some Japanese customers, but you're like, hey, problem solved. Now, all of a sudden, the game takes off in, Western Europe. Now, you got to call up another data center in London, set it up, do the exact same thing. So each time, that takes time and money, is a distraction to your company, and you're annoying your customers. So with Blue Zell as a data cache, what we're saying is, hey, we've got a network already set up around the world, geographically dispersed. Hey, Matthew, take your game, point it to us, and we'll cache that data that the customer needs, and it's already there. So no matter where that customer takes off, it's just going to ping the closest node on our network and give that information. So whether it's in Mumbai, Johannesburg, Cairo, wherever, you know, somewhere in Sao Paulo, we'll have something there, and it's already there. So the player never experiences any latency or performance issues, and your team mm-hmm. doesn't have to worry about setting up and running, acting like an IT company. You can just keep focused on making a better game.
Right, right. I have one last question before we ask you to tell everyone where to find you. My last question is, I understand the blockchain technology when it comes to verifying information. Matthew had this data. Matthew hasn't manipulated this data. Now it's going to be distributed. But why the tokenized aspect for the payouts? Like, for example, if I was using Patreon, like I do use Patreon, and people come and donate money to Crypto 101, I put in my bank information. Every month, Patreon pays me out. There's no really big fees. They take a little bit from Patreon. I pay, of course, U.S. taxes on all the money that I make, of course, because that's what I should be doing, being in the States. But there's really no problem. Why do you choose to pay people in tokens when it's so, say, when it could be easier just to use like a Patreon system?
Okay, so there's a couple ways here. One is we want to get to a point that we can do just-in-time charging. So let's say, Matthew, you're storing your Crypto 101 podcast, data information, customers, all that with us, and it changes every day, right? So we want to be able to bill you on a per-usage basis. And mm-hmm. and whoever is getting paid out at that time, as you're getting charged, let's say daily, we can send money right away. Now, if you use a traditional system with a payment gateway, whether it's Visa, MasterCard, or a bank, it could be anywhere from a charge of, 1% to 3% just for facilitating that transaction. So that doesn't mm-hmm. make it economically viable for on-demand and paying people out every day. You got to wait. Mm-hmm. Tokenizing actually allows us to solve both those problems, right? We can, one, verify that, hey, whatever was done, and our smart contracts show it. And what you're getting charged, it's totally transparent. And people who are getting paid out, it could be done on an on-demand basis.
Mm-hmm. Right on.
So really, it's really about getting rid of those payment gateways and making it more efficient and optimal for everybody.
And people want to get paid out as they're doing their service. They want to get paid out as soon as possible, today, not tomorrow.
Yeah, I know from people in the payment wallet system before blockchain and anything, like they're talking to me about how systems like Uber would work. And you'd be surprised where that money has to transfer and go through different multiple exchanges and go to different banks just to pay out the drivers. And they're probably losing a lot of money just on that. And I look at it, we're basically making that, hey, we don't have to worry about double exchange fees and all that stuff. Just get it to the supplier. They get paid out and they get exactly. There's no extra extraneous costs in there.
Where can people find you if they're interested in your project?
The best thing is probably following us on Twitter. We try to keep everything up to date and tell what we're up to, give regular updates on that. So that's at Blue Zell HQ. And then the other one would be really bluezell.com. It's a streamlined site. Now you can go there, learn a bit about us. And then we have our documents page where if they click on there, even if they're non-technical, they can still read that. It's written in a way that everybody can kind of, what I just explained to you is really on there, like as an overview, the big problem, solution, different use cases, how Bluezell can be used, different industries we target. And it's written in a form that developers and just the person who's into cryptocurrency and crypto technology and blockchain can totally understand it.
Awesome, man. Pavel Bain, CEO, co-founder of Bluezell. Thank you for coming on Crypto 101, sir.
Thanks, Matthew, and keep up the great work.
Thank you, sir. Matthew Finlayson, head of product for Invictus Capital. Welcome to Crypto 101, sir.
Hi, Matthew. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you here. Sir, I'd like to get right into it, jump into it. Tell us the 101. What is Invictus Capital and how did it start?
Okay, so Invictus Capital is a crypto asset investment firm. And we started back in 2017 with an ICO that was the first tokenized cryptocurrency fund that we launched. After that, Invictus Capital was launched as the umbrella company. And while asset management is our main focus, we have a lot of expertise in consulting around blockchain tech. We're very much a tech-focused company with a few tech products and are very big on data science and AI as applied to the crypto asset space.
And you, sir, when did you join?
So I'm one of the co-founders of Invictus, actually. Was there right at the beginning when we were seeing all the craziness happen with the ICOs in 2017 and was there for the founding of Crypto 20, our first product, basically.
Well, I apologize that I know you're the co-founder. You introduced yourself to me as a head of product. I was like, oh, okay, he was hired by some dude.
Sorry, I should have explained that a bit better.
So you did a fundraise in 2017. How much did you raise?
So we raised $40 million at the time and within 1 month.
Wow. Well, congratulations on the fundraise. And how has been the progress of utilizing that money? Of course, a lot of people, when they raised at that time, Ethereum was at a higher rate than it is now. A lot of people has 40 million might have turned into 10 million or even 8 or 7 million at this point. How did you manage your funds?
Sure. So we were quite different from the vast majority of ICOs in 2017 in that what we were raising for was for an asset-backed fund. So your investment wasn't used to start a company or anything like that. We had a product live from day one. And so all the assets invested went into our assets under management. And the whole mandate of the fund was to track the crypto market by tracking an index of the top 20 cryptocurrencies, similar to how you would track the S&P 500 on the New York Stock Exchange as an example. So we were very fortunate that when we launched with our $40 million fund, it was right at the beginning of the crypto bull market of 2017. And within 2 months, the fund value was at around $160 million. As it was just tracking the entire market cap. And now we're sitting at around $20 million after the big drawdown that we've been experiencing over the past year.
Okay, so that's not bad comparing to some other companies that are really going broke, shutting their doors right now as we speak because of them running out of funds and mismanaging their funds. Do you think hindsight, you could have managed your funds better? $160 million, of course, everybody says, hey, I should have sold at the top. But how were you managing and mitigating that risk throughout the downturn into this nice crypto winter?
So, I mean, Crypto 20 as a product is a passive index fund. So the whole point of the fund as an investment product is to track the entire market cap. So we don't make decisions as the investment managers to what we should or shouldn't invest in. It's a pure market cap weighted. The rule set is predefined. So it was basically by design that it went up to $160 million and by design that it crashed or declined in kind with the market. So yeah, I guess the frank answer to your question is that the fund operated as expected. It was just such that the crypto market at the time was declining and you know nobody could have predicted that. And we would have been out of our fund mandate to make any changes to what the fund strategy was.
Can you define what that means, weighted investment instrument pegged to or correlated with the top 20? Now, if the top 20 or the top biggest cryptocurrencies change, that means your investments get changed to something else. Say if Litecoin, it moves from the number 5 spot to number 9 spot, does the weighted, the average of what you're holding, the index change as well? And what is it to? Is it just to the market cap? Is it to the price of the actual coin? Can you explain that a little more clearly, please?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the fund is a basket of cryptocurrencies that you gain exposure to with your investment, right? And the index methodology we follow is one we've created ourselves. And it's very much following a bunch of data science techniques. And we released a scientific paper at the time detailing our approach to creating an index. So the index we've created, which is what the fund follows, is a simple top 20 coins ranked by market cap. Each coin is capped to 10%. So Bitcoin will be only 10% of the fund. ETH will be 10% all the way down to the top, to the bottom 20th coin. And on a weekly basis, we look at the market and we see has the ranking of coins shifted. And if that is the case, we'll take the underlying funds and we'll rebalance them in line with what the market now looks like. So perhaps the bottom coin falls out and now Monero's in the fund. We'll buy Monero so that it's 2% of the fund. And in that way, we track the entire crypto market by holding a basket of currencies.
Okay, that's cool. That's very clear. So I understand why you did that, because of course, if you did it based off of market cap, total market cap, Bitcoin, you would have 50% all the time. You'd have then the next 30% in Ethereum, and you would only have 20% of everything else and like 0.2% of whatever it is at number 20. So that's a very smart way to do that. Is this automated? So when something else moves into the top 20, they just automatically drop it from everybody's portfolios and buy up what is there? And then do you have to pay like some sort of like some spread or maker taker, or how does that even work when you're looking at the trading out those cryptos?
Sure. So it's a semi-automated process in that the index methodology is fully automated. We have a real-time data feed from all a bunch of different exchanges that tells us what the ranking is at each weekly rebalancing cycle. But then the actual physical rebalancing has to be manual because our assets are kept in cold storage. So we'll go to our cold storage facility, retrieve the assets that need to be sent to exchange, and then we trade on exchanges there. Or potentially we could use OTC desks as well if the liquidity required was much higher. Once we've traded on exchange, we'll say sell some Bitcoin because now it's more than 10% of the fund. So we'll sell some Bitcoin and we'll buy some Litecoin and then we'll send those assets back to cold storage. That's an overview of the process.
I personally feel that there has to be some kind of security holes or worries in that process. If everything, and I understand that everything is in cold storage, so while it's at cold storage, of course, you're safe. How is your, one, the cold storage managed? I know you might not want to go into much detail, but I think for transparency and maybe good feelings, we could explain that. You know, cold storage can mean it's on my ledger in a safe in my desk in my office that my kids play in, opposed to being in a bank. And the other one is, it seems like the point of weakness in this process is managing and handling that cold storage to an employee, co-founder even, taking that, having the private keys, making those trades and putting it back in. It seems as though that is the weak spot. And we've seen this many times, Quadriga or what have you, or people that had the private keys do some shady shit, to be honest. What is the security that your customers get?
Sure. So for Crypto 20, and this is something that's constantly improving, you know, throughout the crypto industry. But when we launched Crypto 20, there were pretty much no institutional custody solutions. So we had to come up with our own operational method of storage. And we essentially try to replicate how a bank would deal with storage. So we have a bank-level institutional vault, which has two-party access to the vault with, you know, Swiss biometric scans as an example. And all our cold storage is kept there. So it's like third-party access controlled. And there's essentially two things you need to care about most for cold storage from a fund perspective. And they can generally be broken down into operational risks and technology risks. Your operational risks are having segregated duties within the company or reporting to someone else within the company, so that it would have to require a concerted effort from multiple parties, each of whom is taking risk within a company in order for something to go wrong. And, you know, traditionally, that is how a bank would deal with these kind of risks. And then the tech solutions are, what are you actually using for the physical security of your assets? So as I said, for Crypto 20, we've got operational controls in place such that the people who are accessing the vault are not the same as the people who are reconciling the funds we have under management. There always have to be two people, for example, going to our storage facility. You can't just go on by yourself as a lone wolf. So there is that accountability there. What we're looking to do now for our new fund, Crypto 10, which is actually launching towards the beginning of next month, is we're looking to use institutional grade crypto custody solution. And there are a lot that are coming out. Coinbase has one, for example. Ledger Vault is a solution by Ledger themselves. And this is a more ideal solution where us as asset managers don't even have access to the assets ourselves. We can just give execution commands to the custodian. And so we're moving in that direction where these solutions are specifically bespoke designed for companies in our position and address a lot of the concerns that institutional investors specifically would have.
So I do understand some of the aspects that you brought up there, but two people going to a vault to retrieve something or make trades or transactions just means I have to make buddies with him and we split the booty. with cryptocurrency, it's not like going to a bank. We both go into a vault. We have to carry out $1 million. That's a heavy sack. When it comes to cryptocurrencies, it's a 10-minute conversation. Information time, and then it's, you know, wherever I want it to be, wherever I am, and I get on a plane, I'm gone. So I wonder, with solutions like Ledger was on the show. I had Eric Larsevic on the show, and he talked about his, you know, institutional solutions. Why didn't you just start doing that from the get-go? $40 million should have got you in the door, no?
So at the time at which we launched Crypto 20, which was towards end of 2017, there really weren't that many custody solutions available. Ledger Vault is a reasonably recent product that's come out. And 2019 is definitely set to be the year of custody solutions. And now this is now the time to basically be looking at those kind of solutions that have been launched. The problem specifically in 2017, towards the end of the ICO craziness, was that people were claiming to have all these steps put in place and all these licenses put in place. But it was very difficult to verify that. And there weren't really any crypto savvy jurisdictions that you could rely on to enforce whatever practices they'd said they would be doing. And we'd heard some, you know, in doing our research, we'd heard some pretty horrific stories where, you know, as you said initially, they'd say they've got all these solutions in place and you'll pay them $50,000 a year or whatever it is to custody your assets. But actually, they're just sitting in a paper wallet in someone's desk at work, right? And there wasn't really a way for us to verify this. So it's only now that far more serious players have come into the place and regulators are stepping up their game when it comes to, you know, being savvy about this kind of technology, that it's viable to start looking at the solutions that are being put forward.
Excellent. I like that. I'm a dude. I don't have, you know, $25,000, $50,000 to put into, you know, an index fund. I have $100, maybe $1,000. Do you cater to everyone, or are you only for accredited investors?
So our products are largely targeting the retail market, and you can invest, you know, as an investor with $50 or $10 or $100, whatever have you. And it's pretty easy to do so through our investment portal. We don't accept investment from US citizens, so we have no requirement for US accredited investors.
Absolutely boo right there.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I realize you're you're from the US.
So through your investment portal, you log in, you make an account. How do you do this? Walk me through the step-by-step briefly of how this would work.
So there are two ways. I mean, you can buy directly from us for Crypto 10, as an example, or you can buy on exchange in the secondary market. So if you were to buy through us, you'd come onto our investment portal, create an account. You'd go through our KYC process, which we use a third party for. And we'll have our own internal AML checks. Once you've gone through that process, you've got a verified account, then you're able to send Bitcoin, as an example, to invest, and you will receive C10 tokens in return for your investment. And those tokens represent your proportional share of the underlying funds.
Gotcha. There's a lot. This isn't the first index fund in the space. This isn't the first time I've heard or interviewed people about this sort of idea.
Yeah.
What sets you apart? Why? What are some of the other players in the space that you are direct competitions with? What is that difference that is going to allow you to keep operating and be fruitful over time, as especially with such a fast growing market and fast growing tech?
Sure. So I'd say that the main thing that sets us apart is that we very much take a computer science or engineering approach to fund construction and asset management. So the process I outlined very briefly for Crypto 20 is very much a scientific process we follow to arrive at whatever our index methodology is. And you generally don't see that from pretty much, yeah, from most other index products, I'd say, especially not the guys coming from an institutional space into the crypto market. And you can see that this is the case because they'll create an index fund that is top 10 unweighted and it rebalances on a quarterly basis, as an example. And if you just look at the data or if you look at the past performance of a fund like that, the crypto markets are so volatile that quarterly rebalancing basically does nothing for you. A coin can drop from number 5 to the 100th position in the matter of a couple of weeks. So quarterly rebalancing is too low. And if you do a pure market cap weighted, you're overweighted and thus, you know, over-risked in terms of your exposure to just Bitcoin, and you half your holdings will be in Bitcoin. So the value propositions we have are firstly a data science approach to fund construction. And secondly, because we come from a more technical background, we feel that we can far better take advantage of a lot of the benefits that blockchain technology offers for fund administration or for the finance industry at large. As an example of this, I mentioned that our funds are tokenized, and this allows us to do all fund administration and all settling of C10 tokens through a smart contract. And you're able to receive the underlying value of your investment in Ether via our smart contract without us having to be involved in the process. So this allows us to trade or redeem C10 tokens 24/7 on an hourly basis in a manner that's completely transparent. Everyone can see how our products are priced. Everyone can see the liquidity available for redeeming your tokens. And no other products that I'm aware of are using blockchain tech in quite the same way.
How often do you rebalance?
So for both Crypto 10 and for Crypto 20, we rebalance on a weekly basis.
Gotcha. Awesome. So if this tickles somebody's fancy, if somebody wanted to look more into your company, more into maybe investing with a weighted balanced index fund as you have, sir, how would they find you?
You can find us on the web at invictuscapital.com. We've got a pretty large online community on Discord, which you're welcome to join. Yeah, I guess invictuscapital.com is the point of departure. A lot of our social channels and stuff will branch off from there. And you're welcome to reach out to us. The team's online most of the day on Discord and, you know, on Twitter, etc.
Right on, brother. Matthew, thank you very much for coming on Crypto 101. And any chance you're going to be in New York this May?
I don't think so. I think our CEO, Daniel, might be. I'll have to follow up.
Yeah, man. Put us in touch. It'd be nice to shake his hand.
Yeah, for sure. We'll do that.
You have a great day, sir.
Great. It's nice meeting you, man. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Crypto 101. In our next upcoming episodes of Crypto 101, we have much more 101 episodes. We also have a special interview with Mr. James Altucher, one of my podcasting heroes. He comes on the show, talks about his journey into podcasting, his philosophy on life, and also his involvement in blockchain, Bitcoin, and cryptocurrencies. We also have a great series on FUD from some of the biggest skeptics of blockchain technology in the space. And I can't wait to get that all set up for you. Don't forget to go to crypto101podcast.com, find our social medias there, send us an email and say what's up, and keep listening to Crypto 101.
Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.